Hello and welcome to the Journeyman Podcast. I'm Mark Reeves.
And I'm Joseph Corlett.
Join us as we travel from club to club, delve into the stories, tales and myths that have helped define the ethos and identities of football clubs all around the world.
We'll look at the club history from all angles, whether it be the team's tactical style, superstitious fan rituals, or discussing the best players to grace the shirt.
From our base in Berlin, we aspire to give clubs of all sizes a platform to discuss their greatest triumphs and toughest heartbreaks.
We'll take you through fascinating untold stories with tales of heroes, villains, promotions, relegations, and everything in between. And we're here with our second episode. Just wanted to say a massive thank you to everyone who tuned in for our first episode diving into the history of Blackpool Football Club, the Tangerines. Great to see. They're in the playoff final as we record this, so fingers crossed for them at the weekend.
Personally, I think I'd just like to thank the Blackpool fans themselves as well for their great feedback. Like, we've been active on their forums and things, had some great feedback from them, and yeah, it's really encouraging and we really appreciate it. So thank you, Blackpool fan base, and you really deserve this playoff final and fingers crossed promotion.
Linking back to Blackpool, as we did with our first episode, we linked to our new club we'll be diving into with Barry Bannon, who played 20 games for Blackpool during that Premier League promotion season.
So he made his professional debut for Aston Villa in a UEFA Cup group match on December the 17th, 2008, against our next chosen club when he came on in the 61st minute. He didn't even start. So full brownie points out there to anybody who got this. But of course, Barry Bannon made his debut in the 61st minute in December 2008 against
Hamburg Sportverein, or Hamburg Sport Club.
Or Hartesbau, as you're of a German persuasion. Or, of course, our slowly becoming tradition. Can it be a tradition after two episodes?
Sure.
It's Pez, so it's allowed. If you're a fan of Pro Evolution Soccer 5, Hans Seaton.
Personally, before diving into this amazing club, all that I kind of knew about Hamburg was Kevin Keegan's record transfer there from Liverpool back in the 80s, and they're just like clean, iconic, the blue, white and red like kits.
It's quite a unique thing we'll probably touch on later of how the badge, I can't think of any other team where like the badge is completely different in terms of colours to the kit. Like, it's the blue and black badge, but then the white, red, blue kit, which is quite cool. But the things I sort of knew about Hamburg before this, probably very little. Like, I remember Raphael van der Vaart just being absolute quality before going to Tottenham and then going back after Tottenham, I think. Also, the Croatian duo of Olic and Petric smashing it in Europe, and more like the city itself, the fact like the Beatles were based there, recorded their first few records there.
But hey, let's get into it. Let's jump into it.
And the whistle is in his mouth, and Hamburg have won the European Cup. The trophy goes back again to Germany, and Ernst Happel, the poker-faced Austrian who's been around the football clubs, has triumphed again.
Once again, I think we want to go with sort of some location geography and football geography. So location, do you want to kick us off maybe?
Sure, let's jump into where is Hamburg. So Hamburg is the second largest city in Germany after Berlin, and it's based in the north of the country. According to Hamburg fans, I'm going to try say this, and apologies for any poor German pronunciation throughout this podcast. But anyway, Hamburg ist eine Stadt, in der Steine fliegen, wenn etwas nicht stimmt. Translating to Hamburg is the kind of city where rocks fly if something isn't right.
Yeah, which sounds about right for a port city. As you know, port cities always get this kind of reputation, and it's Europe's third largest port after Rotterdam and Antwerp. So like the main centre of Germany's trade and commerce.
German football journalist Raphael Hollickstein says it's the most international city, it's the most outward-looking city, but at the very same time, it's a very powerful city. Hamburg was always the most rebellious and free-spirited and open of cities. It comes back to being a port city where you get that mix of different ideas.
Yeah, when you talk about it being a rebellious city, probably ties in quite well to what I was just mentioning earlier with the Beatles and based in Hamburg. So like in the early 60s, playing on the Reeperbahn, this like crazy red light district. If anyone's been to Hamburg, you'll know all about it. And I think the Beatles, they had a great time. They were only 17 when they first came to Hamburg, but I think they had a pretty good time.
George Harrison, who, as mentioned, was only 17 at the time, called Hamburg the naughtiest city in the world.
Paul McCartney was saying that, you know, when you got to Hamburg, your girlfriend at this point was most likely going to be a stripper. So to suddenly be involved with some hardcore striptease artist who knew what she was doing, Opened his young Liverpudlian eyes quite a bit, I think.
Back to some more traditional stats. It's the seventh biggest city in the European Union with a population of over 1.84 million people. And it's also featuring over 2,500 bridges, as comes from the fact that it's sat on the River Elbe.
Like the highest amount of bridges in all of Europe. You know, the city, like many in Germany, but especially Hamburg, has survived many disasters through the years. The Great Fire of Hamburg, 1842, the North Sea Flood in 62, and of course, obviously, huge bombing in World War II, but it's managed to recover and emerge wealthier after each one of these catastrophes to the amazing metropolis it is today.
So moving from the actual city itself, we are going to be jumping towards the Volksparkstadion, which translates to the People's Park Stadium, where Hamburg play their football. It can hold 57,000 fans with a strong fan base, with a regular 4,000, 5,000 going to pretty much all away grounds around Deutschland.
I think what's really fascinating, and obviously one of the best part of the story, is they are such a fallen giant now as we know them, but they are still the fifth biggest club in Germany with 85,000 members. Which, to put that into context, like Union Berlin, who've just qualified for Europe, 20,000 members, Augsburg, 15,000, and Mainz, just 12,000. So it's a massive club, isn't it?
Really, really is. Considering, in my mind, Mainz, like, culturally, is, I would have thought, is a massive club, but to dwarf them with nearly, like, triple their numbers in members is ridiculous, something I didn't know beforehand. But moving towards other neighbouring cities as well as their local rivals, we'll be jumping into the Nord Derby. Hamburg's rivals are Werder Bremen, the two most successful northern German clubs.
I think it's one of those things, it's your birthright, I think, as a Hamburg fan to hate Bremen and Bremen fans to hate Hamburg. You know, we've obviously read about the pinnacles of these derbies and things, and I don't think out of any club we'll cover during this series we'll ever get another one to beat 2009 between Werder Bremen and Hamburg, where they met four times in 18 days, which two of these four matches were at the semi-final stage of the UEFA Cup. Talk about having a rivalry already and then putting them into this boiling pot of, you know, European semi-final. It's crazy.
It really is ridiculous. It goes with the cliche lines. For most Hamburg fans, they'd rather win the two derby games against Werder Bremen, which luckily in the upcoming season they're going to have the chance to play the two games against Werder Bremen. Another Hamburg fan states here, personally, I don't hate Werder fans, but in general they seem more entitled, biased and ignorant than any other fans of any other club, which just, like...
I love the, I don't hate them, but here are all the reasons why I fucking hate them. Like, yeah, and also, like, when the fan adds to this, there's something that just burns inside of me when I hear the word Bremen. You know, but they also say, although my hate for St. Pauli reaches a greater height, which probably, you know, leads us into the other derby as well as the Nord Derby, the Hamburger Stadt Derby, the cross-city rivalry between Hamburg and St. Pauli.
This derby is so fierce with it being a cross-city rivalry, so both teams obviously being based in Hamburg, the first match of which goes all the way back to 1924 when they played each other, with Hamburg winning 3-1.
Like I say, so like St. Pauli's first derby victory didn't come until 1930, and this game was played pretty much every year until the Bundesliga was formed in 1963. And from then, they've been split apart quite a bit, with teams playing in different divisions.
Luckily for both St. Pauli and Hamburg fans, they got to meet each other in the 70s when St. Pauli met Hamburg in the Bundesliga, and it was the first cross-city derby to happen in the top flight of the Bundesliga.
The derby, like, became a lot more feisty during the 80s as right-wing extremists started taking over football territories across Germany and across most of Europe, including the ones at Hamburg. St. Pauli fans began to turn their backs and look for an alternative, which sort of leads to how I perceived and known of St. Pauli today, of how they're a club that's all about inclusion, equality, aren't they, really?
We've got some snippets from Hamburg fans stating that they're not right or left. To be against fascism is what normal people are. You don't need a football club like that of St. Pauli to be against fascism. Football for them is for fighting for titles, winning league titles, going for cups and stuff like that, which is where the two clubs kind of separate each other. One is a lot more successful than the other, really, when it comes down to cups and honours type of thing.
Yeah, definitely. But I think this is almost like the niche that St. Pauli have carved for themselves, because Hamburg, like you say, are definitely the most successful club in terms of silverware history. But St. Pauli have like a weird, almost like a tourist kind of thing of like for example, in Berlin, you know, you've got a Hertha Berlin shop, Union Berlin shop, there's a St. Pauli shop, there isn't a Hamburg shop. Like, there are a tourist attraction in their own way because of how they sell themselves. And
it's not so much a political battle anymore, as we've seen in a couple of articles it's wrote, that the derby isn't a political battle, but rather a clash of visions of how football clubs should be managed. The two clubs have fundamentally different structures. Though St. Pauli remain 100% under the control of their members, HSV have become reliant on the financial support of billionaire businessman Klaus-Michael Kühlner since turning their professional football team into a limited company back in 2014.
I think it's safe to say Hamburg definitely had the better of the derby for the first few years anyway. Between 1960 and 2002, they only actually lost one game to St. Pauli. But since the turn of the millennium, they've only won one match, which is when they beat St. Pauli away 4-0. Which is the first victory at St. Pauli Stadium since 1962.
St. Pauli fans love to remind HSV supporters that they're like sellouts or soulless, and to them HSV represent much of what's wrong with modern football, with things with to do with like star signings and hugely lucrative sponsorship details. Does come a little bit off as like maybe a little bit of jealousy maybe, but I feel like St. Pauli kind of do stick to their guns.
You could definitely say that. What I do love, though, about German football especially is how imaginative they can be with their banners and how evocative the language can be. You know, like in the UK, I feel like so-and-so out, like Terry, captain, leader, legend, or someone flies a plane over or something. I just love, this is the translation from German of one of the banners that Hamburg put up at their ground in retaliation to what St. Pauli fans have been saying about them. Rebellious skull and crossbones, sold out. Self-managed home terrace, sold out. Trendy legend, sold out. The person who has nothing left must dance on the pole. And like, not only is this so evocative, it ties back to the whole Reeper Barn brothel kind of thing.
And the logo of the club as well.
And the logo of the club. I think it's absolutely fucking genius.
Things like, as well, the St. Pauli fans retort with things like, HSV, a love bought as easily as that on the Reeper Barn.
Amazing. This is so good. Yeah, your values are almost as strong as your hooligans, responded the HSV ultras. Yeah, I think the thing that Hamburg fans try to get at is St. Pauli are calling them, you know, sellouts, you've got all this money, you're this professional football club. And I think they're trying to say, well, you know, you are still a professional second division football club that's been in the Bundesliga, you know.
How many other teams can have like another club shop? Not in just their city.
I suppose the equivalent is like the biggest team in the capital with a club shop in the city's second biggest city. So it's like Chelsea or Arsenal having a shop in Birmingham. It's a bit weird.
Wouldn't work personally. But I think HSV's TIFO prior to their first Hamburger Stadt derby in the Bundesliga 2 really just like puts them above St. Pauli with, try as hard as you like, but our greatness is set in stone. And you really can't argue with that with the amount of trophies they've got in the cabinet.
I think that is definitely salt in the wounds, isn't it? Weirdly, one of the things we found out while researching this, which I didn't know of, Hamburg have like a very good friendship with Rangers. This dates back to around 1977, when the Hamburg Rangers Supporters Club was set up by HSV fans who had visited Rangers matches and just loved the atmosphere at Ibrox.
The links were further strengthened when Rangers side York Alberts from Hamburg, who had gone to play for Rangers between 1996 to 2001, before returning back to Hamburg.
A weird thing about York Alberts is he retired from football 06-07 while playing for Fortuna Dusseldorf, but randomly came out of retirement to play for Clyde in 2008. He just obviously loved Scotland that much.
For the derby against St. Pauli in the 18-19 season, around 300 fans of the Scottish club travelled to Hamburg to support the team.
Yeah, and I love how Hamburg are adamant that their friendship with Rangers has got nothing to do with St. Pauli's friendship with Celtic. No influence, apparently.
Nevertheless, when HSV played Celtic in 2009 in the Europa League, they showed a Union Jack bearing the words "No Surrender" in the stadium.
Yeah, and when we planned to do, you know, this podcast about Hamburg, I wasn't expecting some inter Scotland, inter Glasgow rivalry "No Surrender" banners in the stadium in Hamburg.
It kind of fits as well with HSV and Rangers both like spending time in the lower divisions of their domestic leagues as well. So there's a kind of kindred spirit kind of feel to it.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think Rangers fans can be like, I know what you're going through right now, but don't worry. Steven Gerrard comes in a few years and wins the league.
Steven Gerrard to Hamburg?
You heard it here first. Or maybe another ex-Liverpool legend, central midfielder.
Didier Hamann?
Xabi Alonso is going into management. What's Jess Spearing up to now?
Das sieht nicht besonders souverän aus. Guerrero dazwischen, Piet Reuper, Westermann, nochmal Piet Reuper, Petric und das 1:0, 42. Minute. Gut gespielt vom HSV, aber voraus ging ein klarer Fehler der Bremer Abwehr.
I think it's best we start with some early history of Hamburger SV as we know it right now. So it traces its roots all the way back to September 1887, which coincidentally is just 2 months after Blackpool was founded. Mm-hmm. So yeah, 1887, when Sport Club Germania Hamburg, or simply known as SC Germania, was formed.
Germania were six-time winners of the Association Football Championship of Hamburg, and in 1900, one of the founding members of the German Football Association.
Germania was one of three clubs that actually merged together on the 2nd of June 1919 to create HSV, or Hamburger SV, as we know it in its present form.
The other two clubs in the June 1919 merger were Hamburger FC, founded in 1888, and FC Falke Eppendorf, dating back to 1906.
Hamburg actually used the founding date of SC Germania as its own date of origin and used the colours in their badge. A fascinating side story that we found out. One of the players from Germania, Hans Nobling, he actually emigrated from Germany to Brazil in the 19th century. And in 1899, he was instrumental in setting up two of the four oldest football clubs in Brazil. He set up SC Internacional, which became part of Sao Paulo FC, how we know it today. And also EC Pinheiros, which is one of the biggest sports clubs in the Southern Hemisphere with over 35,000 members and assets worth over £45 million. And amazingly, it's the club that the most members from Brazil have won Olympic medals, which is crazy how far. Like, this guy must have really loved football. To go from Germania to Brazil, set up these clubs.
Must have loved a Capoeira too on the beaches of Brazil, I'd imagine, as well, after all that hard work of setting up so many clubs.
True, yeah. He loved football and he loved the sun.
Hamburg take their colours from the original Germania badge, which was like a checkered black and blue flag with a white G in the middle. And the merger came about because the three clubs were severely weakened by the impact of the First World War on both manpower and finance. Therefore, they could not continue as separate entities or as separate clubs.
Like I said at the start, that I was always intrigued by and never really knew why or anything, is why the Hamburg badge and the kit and things, it all sort of works, but is also different. And basically, this was part of this merger way back then. The club colours are the Hanseatic red and white in honour of Hamburg, but the blue and black come from the oldest founding club, Germania.
The blue background suggests a link to Hamburg's maritime or port tradition, as the blue Peter flag signal, meaning all aboard or outward bound.
Can we start a campaign for more football clubs to have flags as their badge? Because Hamburg, Hertha, they look great.
They do.
So yeah, never mind any of this simplifying everything into a little circle. Let's have more flags.
Through the history of Germania, HSV can lay claim to being the oldest German football club ever.
So now we move to the sort of early successes of this newly formed club, with the various clubs merging to create Hamburger SV. They became very competitive and contested the 1922 national final against FC Nuremberg, who were playing for actually their third consecutive title. The game, interestingly, was called off because of darkness after 3 hours and 10 minutes of play, drawn at 2-2.
The rematch also went to extra time. And in that era, obviously, they didn't have substitutes. And the game was called off at 2-2 again after Nuremberg were reduced to just 7 players after 2 were injured, 2 got sent off, and the referee just ruled that they couldn't continue.
This is like, I've never really known much about pre-war football and things like this, but I just love how brutal it is. Like, not only are you playing for 3 hours, 10 minutes because, like, you know, someone has to win this game and we're not doing penalties, like, it's just going to go on forever. But also, the fact that you're not allowed substitution. So we literally go on until you don't have enough players, like until the majority of players are dead, basically.
Also, it feels a lot like when you're just losing at FIFA against like your brother or something, and you're just like, I'm going to get sent off. I'm just going to get as many players sent off here. That's what I think Nuremberg were trying to do in this second game. It's
like, I think it's like a cross between like FIFA Rage and the Hunger Games.
Yeah. There was considerable debate over the decision to rule that the Nuremberg team couldn't continue. The DFB awarded the win to HSV, but urged them to refuse the title in the name of good sportsmanship, which they begrudgingly did. Ultimately, the trophy was not officially presented to Hamburg or anyone.
Can you imagine this? Like, nowadays, I suppose the closest we've had to it is last year during the peak of the corona pandemic when Liverpool win their first title for all these years. People say it's tainted, you know, you can't celebrate it, you must not accept the trophy. Like, it just wouldn't happen, wouldn't it? There'd be outrage.
Can't imagine the Scousers giving it up.
So Hamburg's first proper success, one that isn't tainted by, you know, you need to be a good sportsman and not take the trophy and refuse to admit that you won it, came in 1923, just 1 year later, when they won the German Football Championship national title against Union Schoneweide, known today as Union Berlin.
They failed to defend their title in 1924, losing in the final to Nuremberg, but lifted the Victoria Trophy again in 1928 when they defeated Hertha Berlin. For Hamburger, it was the second national championship after its first in 1923, not counting the one in 1922, which the club declined. It brought an end to Hamburg's successful era during the 1920s with four appearances in the German final in seven seasons.
Sadly, as they wouldn't actually play in another final again until 1957, and the next championship win would be 3 years later in 1960. This next section brings us into something personally I find very fascinating. You know, we covered the sort of the war angle of football in our first couple of episodes with Blackpool. Stanley Matthews, for example, started playing for Blackpool because he was in the RAF and he was based near there. But now we sort of see the opposite side of what was going on in Germany during this time. The Nazis actually introduced a new form of football, a new league system called the Gauligas, which were introduced in 1933 after the Nazi takeover of power by the sports office.
This step came as a disappointment to forward-thinking officials in Germany, like the German national team managers Otto Nernst and Sepp Herdberger, who hoped for a Reichsliga, a unified highest competition for all of Germany, like the ones already in place in countries like Italy with the Serie A and England with the Football League.
Yeah, and the Nazis initially had been completely behind the formation of a Reichsliga due to the embarrassing performance of the recently united Austria-Germany national team in the 1938 World Cup. But obviously the Second World War put these plans on hold. Basically, we had to carry on with Gauligas through the war years.
Throughout this period of time, the Nazis occupied various parts of Europe and territories varied greatly. Local clubs and Eastern European clubs, such as Polish and Czech clubs, were not permitted to compete in the Gauligen.
It was different in Western Europe, where like clubs from France, like Alsace-Lorraine, Luxembourg, were able to play in the Gauliga system, but under like very Germanized names.
Schalke were by far the most successful club in this era. However, the 1941 title went to Austrian team Rapid Wien.
A fascinating one is Luxembourg club Stade Dudelange, renamed, of course, in a German fashion to be able to take part, FC Stade Dudelingen, managed to reach the first round of the championship and cup in 1942, which I think is a hell of an achievement.
During the Third Reich, Hamburg enjoyed local success in the Gauliga Nordmark, also known as the Gauliga Hamburg.
Absolutely dominated this league, which is sort of a theme of like, until the Bundesliga is formed, these regional leagues, there's just not enough competition for the big clubs in the area. So Hamburg won the league in 37, 38, 39, 41 and 45. In the 43-44 season, they were runner-up to the SS Luftwaffe team, so you know, we'll let them have that one.
Don't want to argue with them.
Yeah, you're not going to argue with the Luftwaffe.
At a national level, the club was unsuccessful with semi-final losses in 1938 and 1939, their best performances during this period.
Yeah, so the system of the Gauligas is you're all playing each other in your own little areas, and then it becomes a knockout tournament to then play in the final to be German champions. But yeah, semi-final losses, best they could do. But with the end of the Nazi era, the Gauligas ceased to exist, and the northern part of Germany found itself in the British occupation zone, which you'd think, being the British zone, we'd get football going straight away again.
In the British zone, top-level football did not resume straight away, unfortunately, unlike that of in the south of Germany. And only in 1947 was a new highest league introduced, the Oberliga Nord.
Obviously, there's a lot of stuff to clear up after the Second World War. But I thought we'd be straight in there with the Football League. I can't believe, you know, it was 2 years until it started, but yeah.
I was going to say, you did say there's a lot of mess to clean up and maybe football wasn't quite top of the priority after one of the biggest conflicts the world's ever seen.
Yeah, I'll give you that. So moving into the post-war era when, you know, us Brits have finally got our act together and sorted out a Football League for people to play in. Hamburg kicked off by winning the championship in the British occupation zone in 47 and 48. The only two seasons which this competition was staged.
HSV became the first German team to tour the United States after World War II and came away with a 6-0 winning record.
So playing in the aforementioned Oberliga Nord, Hamburg became an insanely dominant regional club, like ridiculous dominance.
In 16 seasons between the 47-48 season and the 62-63 season, they lay claim to the Oberliga title 15 times.
So they won the title 15 times in 16 seasons, which I think is mental, but the only crazier thing is just randomly in the middle of this in the 53-54 season, they finished 11th.
During that 53-54 season, HSV were still the second highest scorers in the league and had a plus 19 goal difference. Only the top two teams had a better goal difference.
Yeah, one of the reasons for their low finish was the deduction of 4 points. These points were deducted because of illegal payments paid to Willy Schroeder.
Schroeder then played under a false name for Racing Strasbourg. They lured him with 80,000 Deutschmark.
He was found out quite obviously, and his ban was extended by 6 months to June 1954, and this actually cost him his place in the 54 World Cup squad, which I just love. I know it's a very different time, but I love to try and put these things into a modern context of like being given, I don't know, illegal payments to this player, you're banned. I know, I'm gonna generate a fake name and go play in France. Can you imagine this situation?
Like, imagine just like Erling Haaland, just like he gets banned, and all of a sudden, who pops up in France? Smirling Marland.
Is that Eric Haslam? He looks a lot like Erling Haaland.
Is that massive 6'4 blonde guy scoring 14 goals like in like 4 games? Who's he? He looks very familiar.
I love the audacity. You thought you could get away with this. Like, I know this is a time before social media, but come on, like, someone is going to know. It's apart from this one season in the 53-54 season where they finished 11th, they would win the title 15 out of 16. During this period, they scored over 100 goals in the 51, 55, 61 and 62 seasons.
It makes it even more mad that they had to like give illegal payments to this player when they were like so clearly on top, and then they felt the need to also like break the rules to stay on top, I'm guessing, as well. But randomly in the 50s, one of the pre-season stories, Hamburg played a very special game in preparation for the 1952-53 season when they played a friendly match against the Indian national team.
Yeah, the game was actually played on a stony hard court, literally like stones, but the Indian players played barefoot and only lost 5-3, so they managed to score 3 goals, which I think is an achievement in itself. But playing on stones in bare feet against a team that's dominated its region of Germany is pretty mental.
Yeah. The Indians must have been fancying themselves in the Oberliga, clearly, with grass pitches.
Imagine what these Indian guys could have done on a grass pitch.
In 1953, the club's all-time leading goal scorer, Uwe Seeler, debuted. In 9 seasons, he scored 267 goals in 237 Oberliga matches.
Absolutely outrageous goal scoring record this guy has, and he just keeps cropping up as we go on from this point forward. Definitely he is Hamburg's Morty.
You noted this, you highlighted this on the Google Doc quite a lot, that it's Hamburg's Morty, which I found quite funny.
Regarded as one of the greatest players in German football history, and he was named as one of FIFA's 125 greatest living players by Pelé in 2004.
He would play out his entire career at Hamburg, apart from for one game where he ended up playing for Cork Celtic FC in a one-off sponsored event in 1978. Seeler had ended his active playing career at this point in 1972. However, this match turned out to be an official match in the League of Ireland, and one which Uwe scored twice.
And what I love about this, like, I can't tell whether, you know, you'd be like satisfied with this or be very annoyed, but his overall record of goals scored through his whole career adds up to 446, Hamburg 444, and Cork Celtic 2.
Uwe was born into a family that was surrounded by sport. His brother Dieter was enrolled to a HSV's footballing team, whilst his sister Gertrude was a member of Hamburg's handball team. And after turning 10, Seeler was also enrolled into the youth setup at Hamburg.
Yeah, and you know, we've seen stuff that compares him to like Luis Suarez. He was stocky, good in the air, low centre of gravity, and a proper fighting character. Like, at this point, you know, German football had not seen this kind of forward before.
He was introduced into the team by manager Martin Wilke.
Yeah, and despite the success in the Oberliga, national titles were a lot harder to come by. But like at this point, the DFB Pokal, like our equivalent of like the FA Cup, is the pinnacle competition in the country. They reached the final but were beaten by Karlsruhe, and this was followed by losses in the finals of the national championship to Dortmund in 57 and Schalke again in 58.
But in 1960, HSV became German champions for the first time since 1928, defeating Köln 3-2 in the championship final. Seeler, who scored twice in the final, was named West German Footballer of the Year.
Yeah, and what an occasion. 70,000 fans travelled to Frankfurt to see Hamburg take on Cologne. They were seen as a superior team, but you know, Cologne didn't have Uwe Seeler.
So strangely, when we look at the match report for this game, it states that both teams scored in the 53rd minute. However, it was Cologne who scored firstly in the 53rd minute, and then just seconds later, Seeler scored an equaliser so quick it was also in the 53rd minute, miraculously.
Yeah, absolute drama, but the fans watching would have to wait until the 75th minute for the next goal in the game, which actually gave Hamburg the lead at 2-1. And a real dramatic ending where Cologne equalise 86 and our man Zila is there 88th minute, 3-2, Hamburg win the title.
He was also the championship's top scorer with 13 goals, the highest total for any top scorer in the competition post-Second World War.
The guy was a goal machine. He was a powerful, gifted, prolific striker. He was renowned for his leadership, consistency and overhead kicks and aerial ability. So you can imagine he was a joy to watch.
He would go on to captain both his local club in HSV and the national team for many, many years.
Yeah, he was a cult hero for Hamburg.
Not a cult hero. He's a hero. A cult hero is like Ragnar Klavan.
Yeah.
Or like...
Someone who was a bit
wanked.
Yeah.
Not like the fans. Yeah, like he did 3 years, filled in when he needed to be, yeah. Did like a funny thing once and scored a goal against your local rival and then like ducked out. No, this guy's a bona fide German football legend.
Legend, yeah. In 1962, the current Inter Milan manager, Helino Herrera, wanted to meet with Seeler to make him an offer he couldn't refuse.
A signing on bonus of 500,000 Deutschmarks and a salary of 155k in Deutschmarks as well was on the table. For a German player to play his football abroad, it would have been likely that he may have not featured for his national team ever again, as this seemed to be the case with players at the time.
Sounds like England in the early 2000s. But yeah, the city of Hamburg wanted him to remain in this place where he grew up, so much so that the Dean of Hamburg University wrote Seeler a letter and said, "If you manage to withstand the temptation, that would send a radiant signal, giving people cause to reflect on their ways." Once again, it's nearly as deep as the fans' tifos in the stadium.
The Germans just have a way with words. The down-to-earth and straightforward Seeler opted to stay in Hamburg.
Talk about peer pressure, though. The Dean of the University of the city... Please stay. Of course he stayed. I think serious pressure on the guy. But yeah, he would go on to have an incredible career. Top goal scorer of the first Bundesliga season with 30 goals. German Footballer of the Year in 1960, 64 and 1970. Third place in the Ballon d'Or in 1960. World Cup runner-up in 66. Chosen the World Cup All-Star team in 66 as well. Ridiculous career.
His 404 goals in the German Oberliga and Bundesliga games is a record that stands to this day. His 406 goals in league games overall make him the second best German goalscorer behind Gerd Müller.
The guy is an absolute god, isn't he? Like a complete goal machine. He later has as well, once again drawing these Morty comparisons, you could say. He has a 2.5 year spell as president of Hamburg, which began in 1995, ended in resignation due to a financial scandal, which he took responsibility. However, himself, he was not implicated in any of the funny business.
He then went on to become an honorary citizen of Hamburg in 2003, the first time this honor had been bestowed to a sportsman from the city.
Yeah, in 2005, Hamburg, you know, they wanted to repay the favor to this absolute club legend and unveiled a statue for him. But it's not quite the statue you would have been expecting, you know, him looking majestic, scoring a goal. And
him doing one of his overhead kicks, as he's been noted as being really good at.
Yeah, something acrobatic and, you know, motion. But no, it's just a huge statue of his right foot, which I think...
No boot. It's not like an Adidas boot, as maybe you'd imagine, or something to indicate that it's like football-based either. It is literally just... I'm sorry to say it, Seeler. It's just a veiny foot.
It's a big veiny foot is the best way to describe it. Like a huge fucking veiny foot, isn't it?
With no context, you'd have literally no idea. So I'm sorry, Seeler, that you've got to blame Hamburg because this wouldn't have been Zila's fault, would it? This is clearly like trying to maybe be a bit too smart.
Like you say, without context, it's just absolutely mental. And like I've been to Hamburg and somehow didn't see this giant, huge, veiny foot. But if I did see this giant, huge, veiny foot, I'd be like, what the hell is this?
And a beautiful 1-2 against Zila. It's a goal! And that puts Hamburg in the lead. So 61 minutes gone, and Uwe Seeler, this goal-scoring machine of West German football, has put Hamburg in the lead for the first time in this tie. It's 4-1 Burnley are trailing now, and that means they're down 5-4 on aggregate.
So after that famous championship win in 1960, Hiersvall would represent West Germany in the 1960-61 European Cup.
The club's first ever match in European competition was a 5-0 win over Swiss club Young Boys in Bern, with HSV winning the tie overall 8-3 on aggregate. Emphatic.
What a debut. In the quarterfinals, Hamburg would actually face English champions Burnley and would beat them across two legs 5-4. Burnley won their home game at Turf Moor 3-1 before Hamburg turned things around in the second leg with a 4-1 victory. And playing for Burnley that night was Jimmy Robson, who, another very tenuous link back to Blackpool, which we'd have probably used if we'd known this before the Barry Bannon link. So he was playing that night and scored for Burnley against Hamburg, but he was also the first ever Blackpool substitute to come on and score a goal.
What a link. What a link that would have been. After two massive ties, 8-3 and 5-4, unfortunately Hamburg were then defeated by Barcelona at the semi-final stage in a playoff game after the scores were level over two legs. I feel like after playing Burnley and Young Boys, being defeated by Barcelona feels a bit more fitting of like European competition.
It's hard to imagine at this point that Burnley are the English league champions. Seems strange, but yeah, then we go to Barcelona, which is more familiar territory. So this game actually took place before the away goals rule existed. So last time out, we covered goal difference, goal average. We're going into away goals this time. So before this existed, in order to determine who would win the game, you'd just have a replay match, which would have to play at a neutral site, and Barcelona would actually win the replay game. A 1-0 match in Brussels, with Averisto scoring the decisive goal.
The crowd of over 77,000 people at the Volkspark Stadion for the first leg against Barcelona remains the record attendance for any Hamburger home match.
Yeah, and just to round off the story of the final, Barcelona would actually go on to be beaten 3-2 by Benfica. And a fascinating little nugget of information was this was the first final to not include Real Madrid, who had won the previous five, and Benfica lifted the trophy for the first time.
We move from Hamburg's first close run in European competition to the 1963 DFB Pokal final, their first cup title. This was the 20th season of Germany's knockout football cup competition.
Yeah, and it was played in August 1963 in Hanover. Hamburg's opponents would be Borussia Dortmund.
Dortmund were considered big favourites, as they'd just become German champions a month earlier. HSV's route to the final included Bayernhof, FC Saarbrücken and Wuppertaler SV.
Hamburg would go on to win the final against Dortmund 3-0 to claim their first cup title. Guess who scored all three goals, including their first half quickfire double on 31st and 33rd minute?
Of course, it would be Zieler. Against the odds, Hamburg won 3-0, and just 10 days later, German football would change forever.
Zieler. Toller Antritt. Na bitte. Das Spiel ist entschieden, meine Damen und Herren. Der Hattrick ist Uwe Zieler gelungen. Uwes drittes Tor. Charlie Dörfel bedankt sich für den Applaus. Und es ist ganz klar, dass die ganze Mannschaft jetzt auf den Uwe losspringt. Denn hat wirklich.
And the change that Joey was referring to is, of course, the founding of the Bundesliga, the long debated step of establishing a top level association football league in Germany.
It's crazy to think in relation to how early the Football League was a thing in England and how long Serie A was a thing in Italy, that like when you think of powerhouses like Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund, that they've only really competed in a unified top division since the 60s.
One of the really fascinating things is how, because there were so many regional divisions, the introduction of this Bundesliga, this nationwide senior association football league, it reduces the amount of first division teams in Germany from 74 to 16. 74 teams are essentially playing on the same level.
It's such a hard number to like cut down. It's ridiculous. It had to be brutally harsh at some points. This finally eliminated the problem of top teams having to play uncompetitive teams in regional leagues. The league idea was first suggested in 1932, but the war and division had stopped it from being possible throughout all this time.
And the process of forming this kind of league went hand in hand with the discussion over professionalism in German football. For quite a while, they were trying to stop it from becoming professional. A limited form of professionalism was not approved until 1932, and because of the rise of the Nazis to power in 1933, it wasn't implemented until after the Second World War.
As we mentioned before, the Nazis were behind this formation of a top tier of German football due to the embarrassing performance of the recently unified Austria-Germany national team in the 1938 World Cup.
The DFB actually received 46 applications from clubs from the five Oberligen to fill the 16 available spots in the new league, which had to be submitted by the 1st of December 1962.
All I can imagine is like this being a very different kind of deadline day.
Clubs from the 6th German Oberliga, the highest league in East Germany, could not and would not have been permitted to play, and they wouldn't be able to join the Bundesliga until the fall of the Soviet Union and German reunification in 1991. So these teams like Leipzig, Dresden, Union Berlin.
The 46 applicants were judged hand in hand with their financial criteria as well as their on-field performances over the past previous 10 seasons. In January of 1963, the applications of 15 clubs were rejected, leaving just 29 in the running.
And sort of weeding out these last clubs that wouldn't get a spot was really fiercely contested, to the point that Kickers Offenbach and Aachen took their rejection to court without success. But both would actually, however, gain access later to the league for short periods through promotion.
Just for the record, for a little bit extra context, there's no second division either at this point. So all these teams are fighting for the top division, because logically you would think, as having something like the Football League in place, you'd be like, oh, well, they're just going to go into the second division. They can get promoted or no. No, it wasn't a thing yet. It was this big 16 teams, or you're playing in your regional league against, as we said, uncompetitive teams. So this is why it was so fortly fought for a place.
Spot on. Yeah, that's a great point. They're essentially creating a Premier League, but below it is just non-league. There's no football league.
Basing on the domination of the Oberliga with that 15 titles in 16 seasons, Hamburg were readily invited to join the Bundesliga for the first season.
Yeah, and would go on actually to finish a very respectable sixth place, with Cologne being the champions.
They achieved this despite parting company with Martin Wilke.
Cologne just dominated this season. They've been at the top without interruption since the fifth match day. Hamburg briefly top of the league on match day 4. But of course, as we sort of alluded to earlier, Zieler would finish the first Bundesliga season as the top goal scorer with 30 goals, which put him 10 ahead of second place Friedhelm Timo Konietzka. And Timo was actually the scorer of the first ever Bundesliga goal.
Hamburg sat second in the fan attendance table at the end of the season with 530,000 total spectators, averaging 36 per game.
The following season in 1967 would see Hamburg lose in two cup finals, but we'd also see the debut of an icon, a multiple record holder, Özcan Akoç.
The final in question, HSV lost the DFB Pokal final against Bayern Munich 4-0. And again, a year later, the European Cup winners' final against AC Milan.
Despite losing the Pokal final, Hamburg actually were in the Cup winners' cup because Bayern had also won the European Cup winners' cup, therefore being the defending champion. So Hamburg was allowed to take part in the competition as a runner-up alongside Bayern Munich.
I'm very impressed you got through that. I felt like a tongue twister with the words European Cup winners' cup. Said like so many times, but anyway, well done.
It's a confusing title to say. I got my head around it just based on like in the FA Cup lose the final, but it's like Arsenal have already qualified for a European competition, so you know, people like Hull City play in the Europa League and get knocked out against random Slovenian teams, but that's a different story.
But back to Hamburg. To reach the final, HSV beat Cardiff City 4-3 in aggregate in the semi-finals, including 3 away goals in the second leg. Zieler scored the winner in the 86th minute. Norman Dean and Brian Harris got goals for the Bluebirds.
And I love, like, when we're looking back at, like, these European competitions and we're seeing the likes of Burnley, Cardiff pop up. It's great. It's great to see, isn't it? That man we actually just alluded to, Özcan Akoç, played in goal for Hamburg during the Cup Winners' Cup final and would go on to play for Hamburg for 9 seasons.
Now, this fella would go on to break so many records and be a trailblazer really for like Turkish come German footballers, for the likes of Mesut Özil and Emre Can. He would be the first Turkish footballer in Hamburg football club history, after Ançuk Unyazıcı. Özcan was the second Turkish professional footballer in the Bundesliga. Özcan would also become the first Turkish Bundesliga goalkeeper, and he'd also be the first ever substitute, after he was substituted out in the 20th minute against Werder Bremen in the Nord Derby after he caught his finger on the right post.
This guy, I just imagine he's got Guinness Book of World Records just lying around his house, like he's got half of them and he's got a few more to come as well, amazingly. But yeah, when he came on as substitute, he'd actually deflected the ball out for a corner, but caught his fingers on the post, these big square posts, like you say. And until then, players who were injured had had to leave the game and not be replaced, or they were ordered to go up front and limp around with their bandages, you know, where they could maybe just have a word in the ear of an opposition defender.
Wind up a centre-back, maybe get him sent off or something.
Yeah, you don't want this, do you? You don't want it, lad.
As the season progressed, Özcan would become a key member of the team, becoming their top performer, and was rated HSV's best player by Kicker Sport magazine, ahead of Ziele.
Yeah, I think that hammered home for me how well this guy had done these last couple of years to actually beat Ziele after we've raved about him so much. Like, and then in consecutive seasons in 70-71 and 71-72, Özcan again was the best rated HSV player by Kicker. And actually, after his playing career ends, he goes on to really cement his status as a Hamburg legend. He coached the second team from 75 to 77, worked as an assistant coach, and also comes back later on as a manager in charge of the first team.
And just to put into perspective how this fella, this amazing goalkeeper, got his start, he made his debut at the age of 17 back in the 50s in Turkey, which nowadays, when you think of like Galatasaray, Besiktas, you think of a rich footballing country, but back then in the 50s, it was nowhere near as developed. So this fella had to work so hard to be able to play in Turkey and then get the chance to impress like he did here in Germany.
Normal service, you could say, was resumed when Ziele was named Footballer of the Year two more times in 64 and 70. But sadly, in 1972, he would end his playing career at Hamburg SV.
During the 71-72 season, HSV finished 10th and were eliminated in the first round of the UEFA Cup against Scottish representatives St Johnstone.
Yeah, that was a name I wasn't expecting to crop up.
Another brilliant throwback name to go alongside Cardiff City and Burnley. Ziele's farewell game took place at the end of the season in front of 62,000 spectators at a sold-out Volksparkstadion. I would bloody well hope so. Ziele competed with HSV against a world selection that he'd put together. What footballing knowledge he must have had.
Things were pretty bleak after Ziele, you know, retires, moving into the 72-73 season without him. The club's relegation threatened in a battle all season. But a sort of glimmer of hope, a silver lining, is they win the first ever DFB League Cup.
Amazing, amazing stuff. In the final, they defeated Borussia Mönchengladbach 4-0 with long-standing player Willy Schultz, centre-back, being another player ending his career at the end of that season. Mönchengladbach's team featured the like of Jupp Heynckes, who we'd know in modern times his incredible tenure as manager of Bayern Munich, winning the European Cup, and Günter Netzler, who we'll be coming on to just in a moment.
And now, as we move forward to the 73-74 season, the foundations of success, you could say, have been laid with that first ever DFB League Cup. For the start of the season, 51-year-old Kuno Klutze takes over as coach.
In his first season, he kept them away from the drop zone with a 12th place finish, plus a great run in the DFB Pokal to the final before getting beaten by Eintracht Frankfurt 3-1.
Yeah, and by his second season in charge, it saw Hamburg shoot up the table to 4th place. In 2 years, they've won the League Cup, they've got to the Pokal final, they've gone from relegation back to 4th place, so you can definitely see this club is now moving in the right direction under Klutze.
Under the management of Kuno, HSV would win the Pokal in 1976, the European Cup Winners' Cup in 1977, and be runners-up in the Bundesliga in 1976.
And during that 76 season, like you say, HSV would finish 2nd place in the Bundesliga, just 4 points behind Mönchengladbach. But they did put another trophy in the cabinet that season by beating Kaiserslautern 2-0 at the Waldstadion in the Pokal final. One of Klutze's signings, Horst Blankenberg, played in that final.
Despite approaching the end of his career, he was widely considered one of the best sweepers in Europe. He'd previously played for Ajax, and in the 5 seasons he'd spent in Amsterdam, he'd won the European Cup 3 years in a row between 1971 and 1973, as well as also the Intercontinental Cup in 1972, the Club World Cup, as it's known now.
It sounds crazy to say, despite this incredible career he'd had at Ajax before joining Hamburg, he was never capped for Germany, never played for the national team. One of the reasons being Beckenbauer played in his position and was obviously incredible. It's almost thinking, I don't know, like Lampard was never capped for England because Gerrard was really good in his position. So it just seems pretty crazy, doesn't it?
But there is, back in those days, there was only space for one libero, and tactical ingenuity isn't quite the same as it is now.
True. They definitely didn't have a tinkerer in charge.
Johan Cruyff even asked him to play for the Netherlands because he hadn't been picked for the 1974 World Cup, but Blankenberg refused, hoping, fingers crossed, that he would get a selection from his homeland.
It would never come. Very, very harsh. Kuna, very astute in the transfer market. So Blankenberg, someone at the end of his career, get something out of him before he retires. But a very clever signing, would prove on to be just an incredible signing for the club, a great service, would be Felix Magath from Saarbrücken.
We'll come back and talk about him in much greater detail later on. During the 76-77 season, Hamburg reached again the final of the Cup Winners' Cup. However, this time, this would prove to be successful, unlike their previous attempt against AC Milan a decade earlier. To reach the final, Hamburg eliminated Keflavik 4-1, Hearts 8-3, Budapest FC 5-2, and then Atletico Madrid 4-3 in the semi-final.
And their opponents in the final, defending champions Anderlecht. HSV would win 2-0 and achieve the greatest success in the club's history to date, thanks to goals from Greg Volkert and Felix Magath.
Coach Kuno Klotzler already knew before the final that he was going to be replaced by Rudi Gudendorf for the new season. For him, winning the European Cup Winners' Cup was the culmination of his 4 years of hard work building this team at Hamburg.
Just to go back to that Anderlecht team that played in the final, Dutch and Ajax legend Arie Haan played his trade obviously for the Netherlands and Ajax, who was actually still winning trophies as recently as 2011 when he led Tianjin Teda to Chinese FA Cup glory.
As we've already mentioned, despite this European glory, Rudi Gudendorf was appointed as the club's new manager ahead of the 77-78 season.
Yeah, and the summer break saw a huge, huge new name arrive in Hamburg. I think the biggest import since the Beatles, you could say. Massive name.
Hatte praktisch in der ersten Halbzeit keinen Gegenspieler. Und Achtung, herrliche Flanke von Kevin Keegan und Milewski mit dem Kopf 2-0. Gespielt 41 Minuten, auf diesen Treffer noch einmal in der Zeitlupe. Kevin Keegan noch einmal, ja das ist einstudiert und das ist gekonnt. Unhaltbar für Wodinski.
Kevin Keegan made the move from European champions Liverpool Football Club.
We've got to think at this time, he's seen it all, won it all at Liverpool. Huge star, you know, and now he rocks up in a little port city in Germany.
I remember asking my dad about this, and he did say that, like, Kevin Keegan, after winning the European Cup, going to Hamburg, that it was, like, a strange place to go, but noted that they did have a good team.
One thing that does come up is, obviously, they're a good team, they're going places, but they had a lot of money. Let's be honest, Kevin, like, as much as he wanted to broaden his horizons, new challenges and things, they had a hell of a lot of money.
Liverpool were paid £500,000 by Hamburg for Keegan, the highest ever British sale in football at the time, and a figure that would smash the German transfer record.
Crazy stats of, while he's playing for Liverpool, his reported annual salary was £12,000. At Hamburg, after all of his endorsements and little deals and things they've put together for him, he would earn £250,000 a year. To put that into context, in today's money, it's just over £1.6 million.
Combined with the boost to his paycheck, Keegan was driven by the idea of new challenges and stepping out of his comfort zone. He traded the European double-winning side for a German outfit who had failed to finish higher than sixth place in the league over two decades. A new and undeniably unique challenge awaited for an English footballer at the time.
German rules at that time actually only allowed clubs to have a maximum of two foreign players in their squad. In the same summer as signing Keegan, they also signed Yugoslavian captain Ivan Buljan. So sadly, it was Horst Blankenberg, our three times European Cup winner from Ajax, that had to make way for these expensive new arrivals.
Despite the Dutchman being sacrificed, Keegan was keen to capitalise on every opportunity presented to him. The deal table by Kroon allowed him to have a significant room to manoeuvre when it came to things like his image rights, and this made Keegan a pioneer in some regard.
Literally like the first person to have like a face deal with his club, launching everything from new Patrick boots, a TV road safety campaign. But for all of this newfound material wealth, his first few months in West Germany would prove a little more difficult than his time on Merseyside.
Hamburg, as the champions of the European Cup Winners' Cup, played Liverpool in the European Super Cup at the beginning of the 77-78 season, and they were demolished by Liverpool 7-1.
Absolutely smashed, and led by Keegan's replacement in Liverpool, Kenny Dalglish.
Keegan struggled for form in his first season, and he also let himself down during a mid-season friendly. He unnecessarily knocked out a VfB Ludbeck player with a punch, which saw him receive an 8-week suspension from football, which turned out to be an unlikely catalyst that changed his fortunes in Germany.
Hamburg spiraled into a nosedive that included a 3-0 home defeat to Dusseldorf and a 6-1 mauling by Cologne.
Despite this, the defending champions played in the Cup Winners' Cup, but were eliminated in the second round against Anderlecht, of all people. On the back of this, then, coach Rudi Gundorf was dismissed.
His successor was our multiple record holder and former Turkish goalkeeper from earlier, Özcan Akoç, becoming the first Turkish head coach in German Bundesliga history. Another one for the mantelpiece there.
Another massive record there for the Turk. But coming to the end of the 1977-78 season, Keegan's form had turned around despite mixed results for HSV, who finished 9th in the Bundesliga. His performance has improved to such an extent that he was awarded the Ballon d'Or later that year, absurdly. Rules excluding foreigners meant that he wasn't eligible to become the German Player of the Year.
And despite having a Ballon d'Or winner, it was still a disappointing season for Hamburg as they slumped to a 10th place finish with just 8 wins from 22 league games. Meanwhile, in the background, Kuno Klutzer, the ex-manager, finishes third with Hertha, which has got to rub it in a bit.
Meanwhile, behind the scenes at HSV, they appointed Gunter Netzler, the former Borussia Mönchengladbach player that we'd featured before. He had been at the club for around the same time as when Kevin Keegan joined, and he decided at that point that the coach needed more authority and appointed Branko Zabek as the club's new manager.
Yeah, after his career as a player, Netzer had offered to publish Hamburg's magazine. The president agreed on the condition that he could do this as long as he also became the general manager. He spent 8 successful years in Hamburg, during which time he completely changed the team.
And what a promotion that the president chose to do, because he would lead a fantastic era, the best golden era for this club.
Yeah, and Felix Magath would say years later that when he came, the great age of HSV began, and when he left, it ended.
With Netzler at the helm, the sleeping giant of HSV truly awoke. One of Netzler's masterstrokes, as we've just mentioned, was appointing Croatian Branko Zabek. He achieved great success in his first managerial role at Dynamo Zagreb, and against all odds, guiding them to winning the 1967 Intercity Fairs Cup, the precursor to the UEFA Cup. Dynamo beat Juventus in the quarters, coming from behind against Eintracht Frankfurt, and then beating Leeds United 2-0 that featured Peter Lorimer and Billy Bremner, a legendary Leeds team.
He then managed Bayern Munich, leading them to their first championship in 37 years, and the first double in Bundesliga history. It's crazy to think Bayern Munich had a 37-year rough patch,
considering they've done it 9 on the bounce now.
Afterwards, he had spells at Stuttgart, Hajduk Split and Braunschweig. And inside 3 years, he actually took Eintracht Braunschweig from 9th to 3rd and just missing out on the championship by 1 point.
Leeds United managed to get their revenge against Branko Zabek when they dumped him out when he was managing Hajduk Split in the 1972-1973 Cup Winners' Cup.
This success at Braunschweig had impressed Gunter Netzer, who wanted him to bring HSV back into those European spots.
He was tasked with changing the work ethic of the club. He had a reputation for driving his players extremely hard in training. Surprisingly, this managerial style would gel really well with the HSV stars. The likes of Horst Hubrich, Kevin Keegan and Manfred Kaltz were relatively calm and uncomplicated in their training, and they really got along with this new strict tactical guideline. It was such a departure from that they'd experienced before.
And Keegan said that sometimes he felt his training was just ridiculously tough, like almost too much. He'd never trained that hard before, and he said sometimes he was so tired he'd return home from training and all he could do was just go straight to the bed, like he was that destroyed by it.
Zabek also had influence on non-sporting managers, making sure that all of his players were in bed by 10:30 p.m. I'm sure Kevin Keegan, as he just said, probably didn't have any problems with that.
He was already obeying. He's in bed by like 6.
Knocked out. And by the end of Zabek's first year at the helm, the net 78-79 season, Hamburg were champions and Keegan scored 17 goals in the process, the fourth highest in the league.
It was the first title for HSV since 1960, finishing with a plus 46 goal difference and their first ever Bundesliga title.
It had been a long time since those Oberliga domination days, hadn't it? And just 1 year later, the team progressed all the way to the European Cup final. What a jump, where they would face English team Nottingham Forest, as well as finishing Bundesliga runners-up in that season.
In the semi-final first leg, before the matchup with Forest, they would play Real Madrid and were comfortably beaten 2-0. And most football pundits had then predicted, obviously, that they're down and out, that's it. And then, amazingly, in the return leg, Hamburg would come back from this 2-0 first leg loss to win 5-1 in the second leg. Incredible performance, which Kevin Keegan said it's probably the most outstanding team performance he's ever been part of. Crazy.
One little interesting fun fact about the sole goal scorer for Real Madrid on that night was Laurie Cunningham. The first British player to play for Real Madrid scored Real's only goal. He was signed from West Brom for £950,000 in 1979. Amazing.
Hamburg would sadly lose the European Cup final to Nottingham Forest. The winning goal scored by John Robertson, who drilled the ball into the bottom corner of the Hamburg net from just outside the area in the 20th minute. Forest then defended solidly, you know, chucked everyone behind the ball to win back-to-back European Cup titles.
I guess they knew just what to do. And funny enough, Nottingham Forest remain the only side to have ever won the European Cup more times than their own domestic top-flight league.
Fluffy, what an absolute god.
What a strange stat.
Yeah, and that Forest team also featured Peter Shilton, Viv Anderson, John McGovern and Martin O'Neill, actually. But a great stat about John McGovern is he's one of only two Scots to win UEFA's Premier Club Trophy, but to never actually win a full international cap. The equivalent of like Andy Robertson never playing for Scotland, but he's won the Champions League with Liverpool. It's a bit crazy.
Right, Charles is past him. Bertels. Robertson. That's the first. 20 minutes gone and Robertson puts Forrest in front. Robertson here takes on Kaltz, goes inside, looks for a 1-2 with Bertels, and Bertels in back, plays the ball when he's on the ground. Boyer almost gets in the way, the goalkeeper touches it, but it's in off the post. 1-0 to Forrest, the scorer John Robertson. Remember, Peter Taylor and Brian Clough said one would do.
Unfortunately for Branco, his coaching methods were blamed, though, for this loss. A capitulation in the league, losing 2-1 to newly promoted Leverkusen, and then the loss in this final were within 4 days of each other.
Pretty disastrous run to throw the league and the European Cup. And there's rumours of, you know, player discontent, like an open war, because the players were trained too hard. He thought, like in his mind, that, you know, the more successful a team is, it can take more training, and suddenly the players and probably their bodies rejected it.
Gives me a lot of like Bielsa vibes, the idea of, well done, you've won 3-0, now get on that training field and run fucking 10 more laps, please.
You can definitely compare it to like a Bielsa Klopp kind of thing in the modern era, where they come in, they install this kind of insane amount of conditioning and a different style of play, huge success, but you know, there's always this, is there a risk of a drop-off or exhaustion kind of thing?
I guess this is the risky play, but the Croatian was a pioneer of this style, surely. The running and the strict disciplinarian approach was just, well, it worked for HSV to a point anyway. So on top of the problems in the camp for Branco, at the beginning of his third season at Hamburg, there was another kind of weird problem also coming to the floor. Branko Zabek's alcoholism became more and more obvious, sadly.
Since an operation on his pancreas, he'd been forbidden to drink alcohol, but according to the Hamburger Abendblatt, he needed it to numb the pain.
Strangely, before an away match against Borussia Dortmund in the April of 1980, Zabek was absent from the final team training session on the Friday and missed the departure of the team bus, so he set off for Dortmund in his own hired car. However, at this point, he'd missed the training session because he'd bloody well been drinking. Expectedly, he was suspended from driving for 9 months and he was issued a fine of 20,000 Deutschmarks as a result.
Yeah, and I think the craziest part of this story is after the police have stopped him, caught him and charged him, they then drive him to Dortmund to meet up with the team. So this is the day before the match. Apparently he held the team meeting in a relatively sober state, but was drunk again before leaving the stadium on the match day.
After spending the first half of the match clearly in an intoxicated and somewhat drunk state on the subs bench, he slept on the team bus during the second half. Branco then went on to publicly apologise for his behaviour, obviously, but it was later admitted by HSV president at the time, Wolfgang Klein, that the seriousness of his illness, of his alcoholism, was covered up by HSV management and the team.
You know, it's a very sad, sad situation, but a slightly humorous thing during one game was when he reportedly came in at half-time and told his players, 2-0, we've lost, this doesn't matter, we've got to win the next match, and it was actually half-time.
So Beck managed to guide HSV to the top of the table halfway through the 1980-81 season, but was dismissed after he was unable to lead training sessions like on several occasions.
Yeah, and his assistant, Alexander Ristich, took over for the rest of the season, leading HSV to second place again.
But unfortunately, Hamburg fans, this is where we are going to call it quits for the first episode of diving into the history of your mighty club.
Yeah, but unfortunately, all good things have got to come to an end. But please do join us next time. We've got a big name departure, a real glory era, a barren spell, and a sadly historic relegation.
So yeah, that's everything for part one of the Journeyman podcast, diving into Hamburg. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and make sure to drop us a like, give us a share, as everything you do helps the podcast grow. If you could be kind enough to drop us a review, as that really pushes us up the algorithms with Apple Podcasts, so that'd be great, thank you. And apart from that, that's everything here from the Journeyman podcast. I've been Joseph Corlett.
I've been Matt Reeves.
See you next time for part two of Hamburg ASV.
Cheers.